I think law enforcement wants that view into what's happening in the crypto ecosystem. Otherwise, you kind of end up with this like dystopian Blade Runner type world, right? Where you have kind of your more KYC AML transactions and then this underbelly of like peer-to-peer in the dark transactions that because you've cut it off from the regulated financial system, law enforcement can't even see what's going on in there. And I don't think that's the direction we want to go in.
Everyone, you're listening to Empire. I'm Jason Yanowitz, and today we sat down with Colleen Sullivan. Colleen is an amazing woman in space who is an ex-lawyer. She is the founder of the company. She is an investor. She is a trader. She grew up Southside, Chicago. Dad was a basketball coach, and just an amazing story. CMT Digital is one of the most successful venture firms in the space. They've invested in over 57 different portfolio companies. They have a really successful trading arm, and they also have a legal division as well. So we got into a whole bunch of stuff. We talked about the regulatory side of the space. And we also talked about her story, growing up Southside Chicago, working in the pit in kind of the boys club of Chicago trading back in the day. So I think you guys will enjoy this one. All right. See you in the show. This episode is brought to you by Luka Tax and Exodus. Stay tuned for more info. All right, Colleen, I am so excited to do this with you. Recording it a little early on my end. I just had my coffee at 7 a.m. over here. Where are you in the world these days?
Chicago. So I've got a couple hours on you, and it's beautiful here today. It's actually in the mid-60s, and the sun is out. So it's amazing.
No complaints. That's great.
No complaints.
Good stuff. You've got a New York hat on, though. For anyone watching on YouTube, you can see this. Anyone listening on Apple or Spotify, it's going to be, you can't see the New York hat, but what's the story with the hat?
Yeah, so a couple things. I have been married for a long, long time, and my husband's from Boston. It started out as a joke just to annoy him to wear the Yankees hat because he's a big Red Sox fan, and it just stuck like 20 years later. So I still wear it, plus not having like my hair done. It's always a good throw the hat on and you're good to go. So
nice. I grew up west of Boston in Lincoln, Sudbury. Before moving to San Francisco. So I too am a Sox fan, and I also am not a big fan of the hat, but that's okay. We'll make
yeah,
it through.
If I had a Bitcoin for every Red Sox hat, and I've got them in green and red and blue that his friends have sent me over the years, I would be like the wealthiest person in this space.
There you go.
So,
there you go.
It's good stuff.
Nice. All right. We're going to talk about for listeners, I wanted to bring Colleen on the show because, as you guys know, we try to focus on founders who are building. Colleen is a big law refugee, worked in big law for a while, is one of the most successful VCs and investors in the space, also works on the trading side of things, and is a founder. So it's the first time we've ever had someone who's kind of hits all four buckets here. And trying to schedule this, Colleen, it was really tough to get something on both of our calendars, so I'm happy we could do this. I want to ask you, what are you so busy with these days? What's a day in the life for you?
Oh my goodness. I mean, it ranges, it basically covers everything you just said. So it could be working with our venture team. It could be looking at something on the trading side. It could be being called into some reg policy meeting, you know, where we're trying to put out another fire in that context. It could also be even things like talking. So I've got a sophomore in high school and twins in eighth grade. I actually spoke with one of their teachers who was doing a class on NFTs. So, and wanted to understand more about Beeple and what was going on with that. So, I mean, it just runs the gamut, but it just never stops. So.
Is there something that you like doing more than other things, or is there something that you, when it comes up on your calendar, you're really kicking yourself for having scheduled that?
No, I think the problem is I enjoy it all. I absolutely love it all, and so it makes it hard to say no. And there's so much happening in the space right now, and it's also new. Like, we're just on the verge of this complete paradigm shift and a generational shift. You know, I see it with my three teenagers. But everything is just changing. And you really, for me, I like hearing it firsthand. I like being involved and in the weeds. And as we grow and scale, you know, I'm realizing that that's something I definitely have to change.
Yeah. How big is CMT these days?
It's a good question. We're headquartered in Chicago. We still have the offices in London and Frankfurt too. The crypto team, all in, we're probably around 40-ish people right now,
Wow.
and growing and growing.
Nice. So, from an outsider's point of view, a lot of people probably see you as this really, really successful, investor and founder, which, an ex-entrepreneur, actually current entrepreneur, which you are all of those things. But I actually want to go back to kind of the early days, the Colleen, Southside Chicago, dad is a basketball coach, four siblings. What can you tell us about just like growing up Southside Chicago and like what your early childhood days were like?
Yeah, so my early childhood was, pretty fun. So I'm the oldest of five, and there's five of us within 5 years. The last two were twins, and really tight, Irish Catholic family. Dad's a basketball coach at a small school. He was also the athletic director there. So I basically grew up in the gym. My mom had five of us. She was going crazy, so she would just send us to the gym with my dad. And unfortunately, I mean, my dream, right? But like Michael Jordan was my hero growing up, and it was such like a luxury if my dad could get standing room only tickets at the United Center for us to, well, and it wasn't the United Center at that point; it was the Chicago Stadium because I'm old. But to see Jordan play like that, it was just such a treat. So I played a lot of basketball, and I realized I wasn't going to become like this amazing basketball player like I wanted to be. So I also played softball. I ran, and running is what really stuck. And it's something that I do to this day frequently. I like to call it my greatest teacher because so many lessons have been learned from running. But really awesome childhood, and kind of oddly, I really became obsessed with Mike Milken and Drexel Burnham and wanting to understand the markets. And I don't think my dad really knew what to do with me. And I was fortunate in the sense that one of his former basketball players was working at a company called First Options at the Chicago Board Options Exchange. So my dad asked his player if he would take me on as a runner. And I started working there when I was a teenager, every summer as a runner. I don't think my dad had any idea what environment he was sending me into. As a teenager on the trading floor, the lessons learned there were pretty remarkable, not just in the context of learning options, but just how to deal with all kinds of different situations. And because I kept coming back every summer, I think then like all of that kind of weird stuff with some of the traders was mitigated because they realized I wasn't going away. And that was how this really all started. And I was really grateful for that opportunity. I was a runner, I was a phone clerk, I clerked in this big pit called the OEX, and then clerked in the SPX, I clerked in IBM. And then my last summer there, I also got to work in the legal department. And what became clear over all that time was I probably wasn't going to be a trader, but this was definitely the area that I wanted to focus my legal career in. But what really stood out for me, especially when I was clerking in the IBM pit, was you could tell that the brokers were working with high net worth executives who held employee stock options. And that their over-the-counter desks, like at Goldman and Citigroup, were putting together structured trades for the like high net worth employee stock option holders, specifically meaning they would collar the employee stock option position or help these executives sell calls against the positions to generate income. And this was in the height of like the employee stock option boom, kind of the height of like when everything was going crazy with the internet. And my thought was, well, why don't regular employees have those same options, literally, like meaning, why can't they come to the exchange floor where it's transparent and have the same strategies put in place for them? So when I graduated from law school, I started a company to do that. So instead of kind of taking the safe lawyer route, I thought, well, this seems like a problem, and these financial products and services should be democratized. So I'm going to start a company around that. And I co-founded it with two traders from the floor. And that's how I met the CMT Group. So they invested in my company. And the problem was we had to get a rule change through the Securities and Exchange Commission that would allow vested employee stock options to be used as good collateral in those hedging and monetization strategies. We had the support of the New York Stock Exchange, the Chicago Board Options Exchange, the International Securities Exchange, all the big players. And it still took 8 years for the SEC to approve that, which taught me a lot of lessons too. And what's interesting about it is that the division that needed to approve that was the Division of Trading and Markets, which has also been a challenging division for the crypto community in terms of getting some regulatory movement on how do we, bring digital securities under the SEC's regulatory umbrella. And maybe not so ironically, it's actually the same people that I dealt with all those years ago who are still in that division at the SEC. But suffice it to say, the company did not make it through that period, which taught me a lot of lessons about building a company where you have an unstable regulatory foundation. And that's what then led me to Sidley Austin, practiced in the derivatives group there. And then decided to leave when I started a family and started working with the CMT group again. And that's
Nice.
kind of, yeah, that history.
Wow. So we're going to get into CME Group a lot in a little bit, but I want to talk about the pit and what it was like working in Chicago, kind of the heart of trading, right? The creme de la creme of where you want to be in the trading world. What was it like being, kind of this young woman working in this kind of, my understanding of the trading floors back then was pretty boys clubby. What any good stories come out of those days?
Oh, I mean, there were so many stories. Yeah. And it definitely was. I mean, especially when I started, it was definitely, I would say, not a friendly place for females. But of course, that's not the majority of people, right? The majority of people are good people and it's all good. But I mean, yeah, I remember my first day, there was this clerk and everybody is betting on something, and I don't really know what's going on. And then everybody stops, like the entire floor, and we all look up at the viewing window above us, and he's chugging milk, like a gallon of milk, and just drinking all this milk. And what people had been betting on is when he was going to throw up. So, and the time it would take for that to happen. And so inevitably, this guy ends up like spewing all over the glass. The floor goes crazy. And I'm like, what have I gotten myself into? And I mean, stuff like that just happened all the time. And and like in the early days, I would, feel like I had to wear this plaid jacket. And I'd feel the jacket was heavy in the back, and someone had like taken a bunch of index cards, stapled them together, and stapled them to my back, stuff
Nice.
like that. Yeah, lovely. But it taught me a lot about just have making sure. Well, I developed thick skin, I guess, and it took a lot to kind of get to me over time. Because you just start to not really take it all that seriously. It's what are you gonna do? And I was there to learn, and I definitely learned. And you learn just how the markets work from like kind of that inception point. You learn about clearing, you learn about trades, you learn about out trades, you learn about broken trades, you learn about margin. Like all these great lessons. And I always felt too, like if you could understand options and you could kind of go backwards and figure out pretty much anything else. So I think it was really good that I started there. It was very confusing in the beginning, though. I remember like you'd have to read, off your ticket, what your market was for something. And I would say like it's 1/16 to a quarter. And you're supposed to say like a teeny and all, and I would just get made fun of all the time until you learn like the acronyms for everything and the lingo. And I mean, it was bad in the beginning, but it got better. And it didn't deter me.
So we had an episode the other day with Michael Morrow, who's the CEO of Genesis. And we were talking about just market structure in crypto and kind of the build out of these prime brokerages and things like that. I think I'd ask you the same question, which is how much has less on the crypto side of things, but more on the traditional kind of prop side of things. Like, how much has the market structure changed since then? I doubt people are, you know, shouting out, you know, 1/16th of a trade these days.
No. Yeah. I mean, it has certainly changed, you know, and one of the things I really liked about the founders at CMT is they saw very early on that floor trading was not going to persist and that where they needed to be was in electronic trading. And that's why the CMT group started primarily in Europe versus the United States. One of the founders is German. And they just saw that early, that was the future. And so in that context, it's changed a lot. And it's also changed in terms of the people who have opportunities to be involved. And what I mean by that is on the floor, I mean, it was like a South Side person's dream, right? Like anybody from the South Side could make a living on the floor if you were good in math and you had kind of the right connections to get there. So it was different. And then as everything switched over to electronic trading, it became the quants at MIT, Harvard, Princeton, Yale. Just who had the opportunities and the access really changed. And, you know, in Chicago, there are a lot of, you know, traders who ended up out of the game because of that shift. So I would say it's changed not only in market infrastructure and, you know, the kind of rise of electronic trading, of course, HFT, high frequency trading. I mean, that's just, you know, remarkable what's gone on there from a tech standpoint, but it's also changed in terms of the humans who are involved in the space.
Yeah, I remember, so I went to school down at Emory in Atlanta, and I remember applying to Belvedere, which was a prop trader.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yes.
In Chicago. And I don't know why they even responded to me because, you know, they get so many applicants, but they basically said something along the lines of like, you're a history major. I wouldn't even consider applying to any prop trading firms in Chicago. Best of luck to you.
Oh my goodness. That's so, kind of harsh.
Yeah. Yeah. But along the lines of, I mean, I was lucky enough. I knew someone who knew someone who knew someone there. And I called him and said like, what's the deal? Like, what's going on? Like, it sounds like I can't get an interview. And he's like, look, at this point, you know, you pretty much have to be like a quant savant to work here. You know, your knowledge of the American Revolution and the Civil War isn't gonna do you much here. So I said, okay, that's all right.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, my nephew is a trader over at Citadel, and he's in the options market making group. And he, you know, went to Cornell, did his undergrad in math, and then got his master's in math. And I think he's the only non-PhD in the options market making group there.
It's crazy.
It's just crazy. Yeah, it's a different world. It's a different world. Totally.
So what, last question on prop trading, then we'll get onto some more crypto and CMT stuff. What happened with prop trading? Like, my understanding at a really basic level is prop trading means, you know, trading kind of your own book, right? And a lot of companies were making a boatload of money. 2008 happens, regulations crack down on the prop trading space, and prop trading got, you know, kind of hampered down as an industry, but I could be completely wrong there. So what's happened with prop trading over the years?
Yeah, it's a great question. So 2008 generally was a really great year for proprietary trading firms because of the volatility. So usually if there's extreme volatility in the market, prop trading firms will do well, just given the way, it's just the strategies that we run. But then you're right. I would say what got tricky for a lot of firms was just really the race into HFT, so the high frequency trading, and to compete at that game is so expensive from a technology build out standpoint. It is sort of like an arms race. And I think, and you're fighting over just the tiniest of increments, right? And I think that just because of the tech spend, you know, only so many firms are going to kind of survive that. So I think if you're in that HFT, you know, space, it got challenging for a lot of firms. But while that was happening, you know, there still are good other products that you can be trading in. You know, the energy space has been really good for prop trading firms for quite a while and remains really good. CMT has had an equity options trading group since inception, and that continues to perform really well. So I think it just depends on like what aspect of prop trading you're in, and how you're set up and what markets you're trading in. But it's definitely become more competitive over time. But there are firms, in the United States that are, just doing fantastic from a prop trading standpoint. Jump continues to just be incredible. DRW, Acuna, Susquehanna. I mean, there's plenty who are performing really, really well. But I do think, it's become more and more competitive and more expensive.
What do you mean it's an arms race? Like what kind of technology do you literally have to build? And my understanding is you have to get closer to Chicago and like because that's where the exchanges are and the data centers have to be like faster than the other one. And so like the wire you have to beat the other wire. Like what does this actually mean to someone who doesn't work in trading?
Yeah, no, I mean that's exactly it. It's all about latency. You want to be as fast as possible and faster than everybody else. And if that means drilling through a mountain, so that you've got the right, fiber optic cables in place, or going, underwater and going from Chicago, over to California and then underwater to Tokyo. It's building out all of that infrastructure. It's microwave, it's cables, it's satellites. I mean, it's just really, really expensive.
And do these firms like Jump and DRW and Acuna build their own cables, or is there like a white labeled, like a service provider who goes out and does this for everyone?
It's a mix. There's some collaboration among industry participants in building out the infrastructure, and then others go at it alone. Others, take a different approach. So it's kind of all over the place, but it really is just this race, to have as low latency as possible. And that frankly was what was kind of funny for the CMT group when we started over on the crypto side, because you go from basically, having as many Ferraris in the garage as you can to WebSocket REST API. And it's like, whoa, what do we do here? Like, this is very different. Just a completely different, shift for us and where we were at that point in trading. So, yeah, different opportunity.
All right, little break from the show to talk about our favorite topic, taxes. It's tax season, right? IRS just pushed back the deadline. It's time to do your taxes. Thankfully, we got Luca coming in as a partner of Empire to help us all do our taxes. Luca just raised $75 million over the course of the last year. They raised from folks like S&P, George Soros. They've been around for years, super legit. A bunch of big names in the space use them. I've been using them for one reason, which is I'm cheap. And Luca helps you do your taxes for $20, right? They save you time, they save you money, they got all the plugins, they make it super easy for you to do your taxes. So if you've been putting off taxes, you're dreading crypto taxes, let Luca make it easy for you. Head on over to tax.luca.tech/empire. Also, just click that link in the description, it'll take you right there. All right, let me know what you think. All right, let's talk about buying Bitcoin. If you're anything like me, you've used a dozen different platforms to buy your crypto over the past few years. I've used every single platform out there. They're all pretty different, except they've got one thing in common, which is they've got these stupid high fees, right? I used to have this recurring buy setup where it was $500 and I'd get hit with a $7 fee every single time, right? So I am super excited to announce that Exodus is now sponsoring the podcast. You might not have heard of Exodus, but they've been around since 2015. Their founders are real OGs. Big fan of Exodus for two reasons. One, you can buy $500 worth of Bitcoin instead of a $7 fee. It's a $1 fee. Pretty big difference. The other thing is they have over 130 different assets on the platform. So if Bitcoin's not your thing, Exodus has your back. Head over to exodus.com/empire. You can also find the URL in the description. And yeah, let me know what you think. That's a good transition into crypto because I've spoken to some of the folks at Jump and DRW, and they have been surprised at how collaborative actually the crypto space is. They said, kind of the traditional, market making and trading scene and prop scene is really cutthroat, right? You're like battling on nanoseconds. It's hyper and, intense and competitive. And then you get into crypto, and really no one's got any idea what's going on. And it's just become you know, especially when you get into things like, you know, the DeFi Alliance and things like that. Everyone's kind of collaborating and working together, and these old school traders are like, hold on, I'm not used to this collaborative environment. Have you seen the same thing to be true?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, and that's one of the things I love so much about this space, because in the traditional trading world, CMT, Jump, DRW, we're not talking. Like, you know, we're not talking on anything like this, and we're certainly not talking to each other. It is, you know, we're very, very kind of underground. You don't want to draw attention to yourself. You certainly don't want to collaborate with your competitors. But crypto is completely different. And from the very start, we've all worked together, because I think we all understand that at the end of the day, this space is so, so, so early. And if we don't work together, it's not going to reach the potential that we all know it has. And there's plenty to go around for everybody, and we're better together. So it's kind of funny. Imran Khan, who runs the day-to-day of the DeFi Alliance, he's the one that came up with the idea. And it was February 2020. And, you know, Kim Troutman, who runs venture at DRW, and Peter Johnson, who runs venture over at Jump, we're already collaborating and working together, but not in a formal way, right? So Imran's like, well, I think we should form the Chicago DeFi Alliance, and it should be Volt, CMT, DRW, and Jump. And I was like, okay, Imran, like, we do all work together, but to do that in an organized, formal way, I'm like, if you can pull it off, I'm all in, but I'm kind of betting against you here. And he literally came back a week later and he's like, they're in. I was like, this is awesome. But it's all to Imran's credit. And it's also to Jump, DRW, CMT, Volt, you know, everybody just understanding exactly that we're better if we work together, and the entire ecosystem is better that way. So it's a big shift from your traditional proprietary trading world, like a huge shift.
Nice. Let's, I just want to give everyone context on, you know, CMT and stuff like that. So my understanding is, you know, 2013, you were pretty bullish on Bitcoin. You said, you know, kind of came to the firm and said, let's start buying Bitcoin or something like that. They said, I think no, until January of 2016, kind of said, look, you can look into this space, but we're not, sure as hell not buying this thing. 2016, maybe January, they start buying Bitcoin. 2017, they launch crypto trading. Then also 2017, they launched the VC arm. Is this correct? Semi-correct?
Yeah, that's definitely. So it was 2013. I was really just, you know, reading a ton about Bitcoin. And I was like, wow, you know, this has the potential to democratize money itself. Like with my startup, I was trying to democratize financial products and services. Like this is a whole nother level. And I was just fascinated. And then also as a securities attorney by background, I was like, what are the regulators going to do with this? Where you have this autonomous money running on the internet that's unstoppable, no government controls it, open to everyone, owned by no one. Like what's going to happen? So I did, you know, I started talking with the founders of the CMT group about it, and they were basically like, you know, you're a lawyer. This is like really weird. You're trying to get us to engage in something that's for drug dealers and money launderers. And they were basically horrified. But, you know, they are very curious people, and, you know, they encouraged me to stay involved on the legal and regulatory side, because that was one of the concerns that they had too. Although we're a proprietary trading firm, you know, we have been regulated in the past. We're currently regulated today. Always traded regulated products, regulated markets. And of course, Bitcoin looked nothing like that, right? So that was good that they encouraged me to do that. And that's how we kind of got our start on the legal policy side of things, you know, working with the Chamber of Digital Commerce really, really early on, and all kinds of other initiatives. Like we were calling for self-regulation and crypto like in early 2014. We're just way too early with these kinds of thoughts and concepts. And then, you know, as part of our traditional trading business, we're trading on the Shanghai Gold Exchange. And I was in China with the founders of the CMT group, and I brought them to the BTCC, which is one of the oldest crypto exchanges in Shanghai. It was run by Bobby Lee, Charlie Lee's brother. And I don't even know if Samson will remember this, but Samson Mao was the COO at the time. He's currently with Blockstream. And, you know, we go into this like high rise in Shanghai up in this like, you know, the top floor, kind of like smoky conference room. And Samson starts talking with us about the halving that's going to be happening in July of 2016. And, you know, while I was in this to like, we're going to democratize everything, it's going to be better for everybody in the world, you know, I think my two partners were like, oh, this asset is going to become more scarce. And this happens every 4 years. That's really interesting from a trading standpoint. Let's load the boat with Bitcoin, you know? So, as much as I would like to take credit for like being the one that finally got them there, I actually think it was Samson Mao. So, and I should probably tell him that at some point. And that's where it started. And then, yes, you know, you're right. It went from there to, well, this is really interesting. Why are we seeing these strange prices across different exchanges? And is there an arb opportunity there? So we slowly started connecting to all of these different platforms, which was kind of funny for our IT guys because they were like, what are these things? Like, so slow, they break all the time. Like, what is this? But what was great about being so early is we started to understand all of the operational frictions, you know, associated with being involved in crypto early. Like, you know, you'd see crazy prices in Korea versus the United States. And as you set up in Korea, you start to realize, well, it's really hard to move yuan out. So that is happening for a reason. And so then when those crazy arbitrage opportunities happened in the back half of 2017, we were already set up and ready to go. And then it just became a matter of like staffing up as fast as possible. So we had people, you know, trading 24/7.
Yeah, because I was going to ask, I know a lot of firms that launched trading desks in 2017 and also launched venture arms in 2017 just because the market was so hot. And a lot of them have kind of fizzled out or not done so well, or I don't know, maybe they made a few pot shot investments here and there. But I'm looking on your guys' website here. You've invested in 40 companies, 50 companies?
I think we're at 57 now, yeah.
57, you've got like Falcon X, Silvergate, Bakkt, BlockFi, Abra, Circle, Digital Assets Data, you know, I mean, I'm not going to name all of them, but you know, a few unicorn companies in here. Like what do you think it is that has made your guys' VC arm so successful, whereas a lot of other ones fizzled out?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. So I pretty firmly believe that if you're going to be investing in crypto, you need trading and investing to work together. So our venture team and our trading team are essentially one, and we operate that way. So like if you take BlockFi, for example, Brad Copen, who runs our trading desk, you know, felt really strongly that in order for this space to grow, we have to have more mature borrow lend markets. And, you know, we had met Zach and Flory, and then we met Renee on that team. And we were like, we think this team is going to be the one to do it. But I mean, it was really informed by the trading side of the business. And that's why we started investing on a venture basis, was really because on the trading side, and frankly, on the legal and regulatory side, too, we just started to see all of these gaps, you know, gaps in infrastructure. And we really were all convicted that the space wasn't going anywhere. We are in a paradigm shift. It's going to keep growing. So let's start investing where we see those gaps. And, you know, so I think that it is from day one, the combination of investing and trading. And then I think it is helpful having that, you know, legal regulatory view on the space too, just kind of understanding how that may evolve in the future. But I think that's, you know, one of the things that is a little bit different about us, that mindset. And I think it's no accident that you had firms like CMT, DRW, Jump, Acuna, you know, early to trade in the space because it's our own capital. So we can take more risk versus managers who are managing third-party capital in terms of trading, especially at that time, because, I mean, we had to self-custody everything. You know, there were no custodians that we trusted with our assets more than we trusted ourselves. And, I mean, that's tricky, right, with bearer assets that, you know, you are custodying. And obviously, so much of that infrastructure wasn't there in the early days. So I just don't think the space was suitable for third-party capital. And that's why you've got the prop firms in there. And then we all saw kind of the same gaps. And that's why I think you also saw Jump, DRW, Acuna, and others, nutritional prep training firms, now becoming venture investors too, because we're seeing these gaps and going in where we think they need to be filled.
Okay, this is a good segue into one thing I wanted to ask you about, which is, governments have fear when they can't control the money, and your startup had to go through 8 years of regulation, and we're talking about DeFi. Back in was it December maybe? Mnuchin, however you pronounce his name, set brought down those pretty crazy anti-crypto suggestions or regulations, and I know they didn't eventually go through, but my memory, and I don't work in regulation, but my memory was he said basically you have like 7 or 8 days to figure this out. And he said it's going to be this better, KYC and money. It's going to help with KYC, or we'll implement better KYC, which will help with money laundering. I've heard you say that that would really just create a massive payment surveillance system. You also work with the regulators a lot. So I want to hear, like, what's the pro side of that? What's the con side of that? Like, what are your thoughts around what he was trying to do?
Yeah. So, and what was going on there iterated over time. So, I think there was an initial belief that you could ban peer-to-peer crypto transactions altogether. And then I think there was a realization that that's really not possible. And then, it morphed into something else. And so first and foremost, one of the problems there was the administrative process or lack thereof, where this ruling was actually going to come out as an interim final rule where it would have been effective immediately without giving industry any time to comment. And then, as you note, they did give us a very small window to comment. And kudos to the crypto industry because FinCEN received over 7,000 comment letters from industry, which is just remarkable. And it wasn't just quick emails in. There were substantive comment letters that went in. People basically gave up their holidays entirely. I was one of them, and just worked around the clock because there was just a lot of, I'll be kind and say, misunderstandings.
I remember Jake Chervinsky was telling, like, I think Jake worked pretty hard on that as well. Shout out,
Jake
Jake.
was amazing. Yeah, Jake, there are certain people in our industry who are really basically a gift to our industry. And Jake is one of them. I think Mark Boren at DYDX, Rebecca Redig at Aave, Marvin Amori at Uniswap. You think about the talent of the general counsels leading the blue chip DeFi projects, and it's remarkable. And they're just fantastic attorneys and fantastic people, which should give people some idea that DeFi is here to stay when you've got talent like that on the legal side heading up, those projects from a reg standpoint. It's remarkable. But yeah, in the United States, we have constitutional rights, and privacy is something that has been a bedrock of the United States for a long time. And the direction we were heading in was basically building out, a massive surveillance system. And the problem was there was no discussion around that. And thankfully, we've slowed all that down. And I think we will have robust conversations in that context. But we have to be careful. We have to find the right balance between understanding law enforcement's goals, which are reasonable, but also protecting people's privacy. And there was just no discussion that was going to happen in the context of what was going on over the holidays. And again, that has changed now, which is good.
Do you think we'll eventually live in a world where there are kind of two types of Bitcoin? Bitcoin that have been KYC AML'd and like live on places like Coinbase, and then Bitcoin that's kind of off of the KYC AML system?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly could. And I think I think we're making progress in regulators understanding, I mean, Bitcoin's actually a really bad tool for criminals to use. All transactions are happening on a public blockchain, and with the way analytics are today, I mean, it's pretty easy to figure out what's going on. And I think law enforcement wants that view into what's happening in the crypto ecosystem. And I think that's why it's important that you don't, cut off regulated financial institutions from crypto. Otherwise, you kind of end up with this like dystopian Blade Runner type world, right? Like as you describe, where you have kind of your more KYC AML transactions and then this underbelly of like peer-to-peer in the dark transactions that because you've cut it off from the regulated financial system, law enforcement can't even see what's going on in there. And it's not because people are doing bad things, but maybe people want privacy, right? I mean, so it's and I don't think that's the direction we want to go in. I think that there's a very good middle ground that we can achieve. And I also frankly think we can use the technology itself to help law enforcement. We don't have to be stuck in the same ways of, monitoring transactions. Like there's different things we can do here that can help us achieve the same objectives. It's just regulators, policymakers, and industry working collaboratively to get to that point. I'm a glass half full kind of person. I think that's what will happen. But it's really incumbent on everybody in the industry to keep trying to educate and to be involved, which we saw over the holidays. I mean, people absolutely were, which was
Yeah.
great.
How do you think the new administration, like Gary Gensler and Biden's administration, how do you think the new administration will impact regulation on the crypto space? Will it be net positive or net negative?
I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful
Always the
that,
optimist, Colleen.
yeah, I mean, you kind of have to be, right? I think, we've got a new progressive administration. And when you think about the power of crypto from a financial inclusion and accessibility standpoint, it's something that the administration should embrace. But again, it's incumbent on industry to show regulators and policymakers how we are actually making a difference in that context. So, trying to close the inequality gap, which I think crypto can help with, bringing more diversity into the space, which we absolutely need to do. And I think, frankly, we're lacking in that area right now. So we all need to do better. But what we're building in crypto is something the new administration should embrace. We've got some stuff going on with FATF, and the United States is just one country out of 39. It's a global initiative that we're going to be dealing with that for a while. We'll see what happens in June. But so the United States is just a component of that. It's a global effort there. And then with the SEC, I'm really hopeful that Chairman Gensler will work with Commissioner Peirce. The second iteration of her safe harbor, I think is fantastic and just so needed in the industry. We need clarity because what we see happening, often we're talking to entrepreneurs in Singapore or Switzerland, and they're American and they've left because they want to go someplace where the rules of the road are clear. Nobody wants to break the law. I mean, people just want to know, what can I do? What can't I do? And that's where we're failing here. And Commissioner Peirce has just, some great guidelines out there that will help mitigate a lot of the issues that we've seen. The CFTC has historically been very friendly to the crypto space. I think so much credit to former Chairman Giancarlo for allowing the CME Bitcoin futures to go through that self-certification process. I think that was a big shift for crypto into having, a more institutional base for this new asset class. And we don't know who the head of the CFTC will be yet, though, but I'm hopeful that, that person will continue that legacy that the CFT has of collaborating with the industry. Those are kind of the primary, players, FinCEN, Treasury, SEC, CFTC. And then, of course, you've got the IRS, you've got, all kinds of different other agencies that are sort of more on the fringes there. But we need to put in the effort as an industry to, keep educating and keep the dialogue open and keep collaborating and really care about that. And I think if we do, I think we'll end up working together. That's my hope.
Yeah, my hope as well.
Yeah.
All right, we've talked a lot about the investor calling, the regulator, the lawyer calling, and the trader. But I want to hear just a little bit about the founder side. So how's it been? You mentioned earlier you've nearly 40 people or mo a little more than 40 people working at CMT Digital. How's it been just scaling a team from 0 to 40 people in just a few years?
Yeah, I mean, so fortunately, we are able to lean on the resources of the broader CMT group. So that has definitely made my job easier. We have a fantastic operations team that's been at this for a really, really long time. And then, so that means great support on the accounting side, on the tax side, the IT side. So kind of all these things that really matter. And so that's certainly been helpful. It has been a combination of scaling and descaling and scaling. And what I mean there is, again, lessons learned, right? So the back half of 2017, we were just hiring, 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 hiring. Trying to just get as many people who we could trust because there was just so much movement of coin and fiat going all over the place. And we had to build, I mean, and there was Fireblocks didn't exist, right? Things like that weren't there. So we had to build protections in to make sure that, traders couldn't send coins to themselves. Traders couldn't send, and just build all this out. So it was a huge lift by our IT guys to kind of secure our own infrastructure and then just getting people in. So we scale up, scale up, scale up. And we knew this arbitrage opportunity wasn't going to last forever, but I don't think we realized how fast it was going to go away. So we're scaling and then we go out to Tokyo and Seoul. We reopen those offices, which had, we used to have on the, traditional side of the business, and we decided to reopen for crypto. And it's probably now, midway through 2018, and I'm like, huh, I think we're in a legit bear market. And we have all these people, we've scaled up so quickly, and I think we're going to have to make some changes. But continued with the same team through the end of the year. And then in January of 2019, we had to make some cuts, and it was brutal and like heart-wrenching. It was really, really hard, like really hard. And I talked a lot with the two founders of the CMT group who are my partners in CMT Digital about it. And they reminded me basically the reason we've been here for 24 years is because these are things you have to do when things are hard. And if you don't make the cuts, you don't survive. And the key is surviving, especially in a nascent industry like this.
All right, we're coming up on time here, so we're going to start to wrap it up. I have one or two more questions here, and then we can finish if you want to flip the interview and ask me one question. So one thing I'm wondering is we just talked about laying people off, which I've had to do, and it's by far the hardest thing I've ever gone through. I wouldn't call that really a controversial decision, though. It seemed like something that had to be done. What do you think is the most controversial or toughest decision you've had to make either at CMT or pr before CMT?
That's a great question. I have to think about that because I feel like we have to make a lot of tough decisions all the time. Controversial, though, I need to think about that.
All right, I can ask you the other one if
Yeah.
you want to.
All right. I got to think about that
I
one.
have a more fun one
Good.
to ask you here. So you've invested in 57 portfolio companies. You've seen, I mean, and it runs the gamut, right? From gaming to DeFi to market infrastructure for a traditional Wall Street crowd. Who are some of the most impressive entrepreneurs right now inside of crypto?
Oh my gosh, I love Jack Mallers. So, Jack is probably—I mean, I can't have favorites, right? Because I love everybody. But Jack is just—he's just remarkable. We were fortunate to meet him early on, And just his vision, his ability to execute, his talent. He's also just a really kind human being. And he also, he's in a position where he not only thinks about, what's best for Zap, what's best for Strike, what's best for our investors, but what's best for Bitcoin, what's best for the entire ecosystem. And I've really appreciated just, working with him, collaborating with him. He's very, very thoughtful. He's very passionate. He has all of the elements that just make for a successful founder and just a fantastic human being. And he's one of a handful of experts, and he truly is an expert, right? I don't think any of us are like experts in this space because the space is still just shifting and changing all the time. So I always laugh when I see like experts, but Jack is an expert. Like Jack is an expert in the Lightning Network, in Bitcoin, and just one of a handful of people in the world. He's just phenomenal.
Yeah,
So,
I completely
yeah.
agree. I mean, he just I don't know when we're gonna release this podcast, probably pretty soon, so I won't say too much about what they're coming out with, but the big news that recently happened was they're helping, they just helped the NFL player move 100% of
Yep.
his salary into Bitcoin, which is a really cool thing that was, public news and everyone could see that. So yeah, I think Jack has done an amazing job of basically getting the entire industry behind him and supporting him. I was talking to one of their main competitors the other day, and he basically said, he's like, look, we're fighting an uphill battle here because the entire industry likes Jack. So
Yeah. Well, the good news for whomever that is that I think, again, the space is so early and there's
of
so much
course.
opportunity. There's room for so many different players, but Jack is just, he's unique in every way, in a great way. But yeah, he is just, and it's amazing too because he's still so young. Like where he's gonna go, I mean, it'll be incredible.
Totally.
He's just, yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah. All right, back to the hard one. You have
I
any
know the
controversial
controversial
decisions for
one.
me?
Oh, I mean, I'm sure if you asked my team, they would be like,
What
spewing them out one after the other. But I gotta think about that. I feel bad.
do you remember the day that you decided to shut down your first startup?
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. So I'm embarrassed to even tell you this. So it is still not even formally shut down because
Hanging on by a thread.
I couldn't let it go. I couldn't let it go. Yeah. No, and what still persists is we have a patent on the it's a business method patent, like pre-Alice, which is this like patent decision. Yeah, just can't let go. So
Fair
it's
enough.
still alive. So
Yeah.
yeah, I still haven't shut it down.
All right, you can, if you want, flip the interview if you want to ask me one question, and then we can wrap this up.
Yeah, well, what's it been like building Blockworks? And how did you guys decide? I'd love to hear your story a little bit, like how you
Yeah.
came into this. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean the backstory goes back to my family is Hungarian. So in 2015 I went and lived in Budapest, Hungary for 6 months, and the Hungarian students at this university called Corvinus University were really into Bitcoin because it was, their parents lived under this communist regime. And like when you take the trolley in Budapest, like everybody is dead silent because, their parents lived under this regime where you had like video cameras and microphones on the trolleys. So these students naturally loved Bitcoin because it was, kind of freedom from money and from government and things like that. So that's when I first heard about it. I come to New York, I start working in venture capital at this firm that invested in like kind of mid to late stage like life science and tech companies. And I was the young guy at the firm, like the young analyst who just like made calls and put together decks and things like that. And I remember I was working for these old school like Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns guys, and I basically was
Oh.
like badgering them. I'd be like, hey Tim, like Bitcoin, like I think we should buy Bitcoin. And they basically like patted me on the shoulder and said, yeah, that's cute kid, get out of my office. And finally they let me, share some resources with them. So I was like, oh my God, all right. The partners are like gonna let me share resources. So I went and did some research, and all I could find to send to these like real old school Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers guys were like Reddit threads
Oh, interesting.
and Twitter, and I could invite them to some events, but the events were like a load of crap back in 2017.
They were so bad.
So bad. And so that's when the idea kind of hit me, which was there's got to be a better way to get information about this new asset class to more old school investors. And I wasn't even thinking like big media company and big podcasts and all that stuff. And so I linked up with two friends, one of whom is Mike Ippolito, who's our co-founder. The other is a guy named Sebastian, who's now at Galaxy Digital. And we just started hosting events, actually. So this whole thing started with in-person events for kind of the suit and tie crowd. So instead of bringing, your 20-year-old hackers to an event, which I love those events, we would bring, the head of crypto, Goldman Sachs, right, to come speak about what they're working on. And after like, actually, it was, we hosted one event and it went really well, and then we quit our job actually because we realized we could maybe make more money hosting events than we were in our day jobs. And that was May 1st of 2018. So we're coming up on, it's been 3 years now. And the goal has always been the same, which is just to help this more institutional crowd understand crypto. We were probably just like you guys, maybe a little too early to that. But now that thesis is really panning out and things are going well, so.
Yeah, and the content you guys are putting out is awesome. I love reading it. It's very differentiated. I look forward to getting it every day in my inbox. It's really good, like really outstanding. So I love the shift into broader content too. I think it's great. And it's funny you say Budapest. So my daughter had the opportunity to play ice hockey in Eastern Europe, well, in 2014 and in 2015, but this was in 2015, and we went to Budapest as part of that trip. And she was super excited because there were a couple of merchants that had "We accept Bitcoin here" on the doors. And she was like, "They accept," and that was the same in Prague. And we were also in Bled in Slovenia and in Slovakia. And it seemed like a bigger thing in Eastern Europe than it was in the United States. Like, I just remember her being so excited about seeing like the "We accept Bitcoin" stickers on a bunch of different merchant doors, but especially in Budapest. So
Totally.
it's interesting that you
Yeah.
say
I mean,
that.
if like we talked about market structure earlier in the podcast, right? And if you remember back in 2013, maybe, the only exchanges that ex there were two exchanges. It was Mt. Gox in Tokyo and Bitstamp, which at the time was in Slovenia. And so there's this thriving crypto community out in Eastern Europe. And actually a lot of the companies that probably a lot of the listeners use today that seem more like US companies, which are they are US companies and they're Western European countries, they are companies, they have a lot of their development teams and engineering teams are in Eastern Europe. Not because it's cheaper, well, oftentimes it is cheaper, but these engineers are
The
phenomenal.
talent.
Yeah.
Yeah, the talent's amazing because yeah, we see pockets of engineers like in Croatia, but yeah, all areas of Eastern Europe. It
Yeah.
is really pretty interesting. Yeah, I remember, I mean, Bitstamp being in Ljubljana, and when my daughter played in Bled, I was like, we need to go see the Bitstamp people because they're just, really close. So yeah, it is. It's very cool. That is a really cool start.
Yeah.
Because it all starts with a need, right? And you saw the need and the lack of what the market was producing there. And here you are with Blockworks, which is
And here we are.
awesome.
So,
Here we are.
yeah,
It's good
I'm
stuff.
glad that you're enjoying the newsletter, Colleen. Thank you.
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Yeah, Tyler, the writer is amazing. So,
Yeah,
anyways,
he's
Colleen,
excellent.
thank you for joining me. This was an awesome conversation. Are you guys hiring right now? Are you where can people go if they want to either work there or if they want to learn more about you guys or learn more about yourself?
Yeah, so we are hiring. We've got the jobs posted on our website. It's just cmt.digital. And would love to hear from anybody interested. And while we have specific jobs up there, we are always hiring just basically talent, people who are passionate about the space. And one of the things I love about CMT is it's very opportunistic. So I feel like it's a place where if smart people come in and join the team, they can kind of build on our platform, if you will. whatever they're passionate about. We really are that kind of a team where we welcome that kind of innovation from within. So although we do have set jobs, if you're really smart and passionate about the space and you want to get involved, let us know.
Yeah, we have the same thing, by the way, and it's like, yeah, we have a marketing role and a sales role and an engineering role open, but yeah, I mean, there are so many smart people who don't fit into a bucket these days. So yeah, I think they're
Yeah.
smart.
I think that's the only philosophy. I think that's the way to go in this space, or else you just miss out. You miss out on that talent. And, like I said, I don't even think we've scratched the surface of where we're going. I don't think our imaginations can even take us there. So I think bringing in talent, and that's where I think I love Belvedere, but I think they missed the boat with you. I think that we need, people from all different disciplines in this space, because that's what's going to make it thrive and grow. And it's disciplines, it's backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds, it's diversity. Like, we need it all, because the crypto touches everything, right? So I think having a really open mind about who you bring on to your team and what unique skill sets they can bring is really important.
Yeah, I completely agree. So,
So,
all right,
yeah,
Colleen.
cool.
Well, hope you have a
Thanks,
nice rest of
Jason.
the day in sunny Chicago.
You too. I really appreciate this. It's been a lot of fun. Thank
Yeah,
you.
likewise. All right, that was Colleen Sullivan. Hope you guys enjoyed it. At the very end of the show, she mentions our newsletter. If you're not subscribed to our newsletter, head over to blockworks.co/newsletter. Hit that subscribe button. I think you guys will enjoy our daily newsletter if you're enjoying the content on this show. All right, see you next week.